life is a blessing, and I'm always willing to share these blessings with everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tennessee Froward's Reading How. I'm your host, Felicia Baxter. This is my 8th podcast of Christmas, the Expanded Notes Edition. I'll be talking about why Ma Rainey's Black Bottom that premiered this past Friday on Netflix is definitely a Oscar or Emmy contender. And also just the general beautiful music of the season. I'll be talking about what I ate today, Sunday meals rule, as well as what I'm reading and adding to Chatterbooks. And thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. So it actually premiered, or Ma Rainey's Black Bottom premiered this past week on Netflix. It premiered on Friday. And just from IMDb, of which I hope my works will one day be presented. It's basically a service that all of your theatrical credits and writings, etc., are all listed. It's like a database for actors and actresses and also production studios, I guess. But this is taken directly from there. It's Chicago, 1927, a recording tension and a recording session. Tensions rise between Ma Rainey, her ambitious horn player, and white management determined to control the uncontrollable mother of the blues, based on Pulitzer Prize winner August Wilson's play, Ma Rainey. When I initially heard about it over a month ago, I was looking at why did they have Viola Davis dressed up like a caricature of herself? Why did they have her in grease paint and this lumpy kind of padded body suit? But if you read about the incomparable Ma Rainey, you will know why they did this. This was an authentically complete immersion of a larger-than-life character of the early 20th century. She characterized what became known as race music and race records, the blues. The blues, in the words of Ma Rainey or Viola's character, signifies a history, a oral history that was completely left out of our whitewashed United States history. It made or allowed Ma Rainey to get up in the morning. It allowed her to express herself and be beautiful when I'm sure, because she did not have the Bessie Smith body of it all. It allowed her to express her deep sorrowness or beauty and love for herself. She was brass, loud, and difficult. And I look at some pictures of her, Getty's images of her and her thick neck and shield chest, and she looks like she has Turner syndrome, but that's a whole different discussion. But I do think that she allows whoever listens to her to go with her to that point, and to go, and you just are just grateful for the ride. It basically exemplified, and some of the songs that were on the record exemplified how we were treated at the time. In one particular poignant session, the Gil Turman character made it seem like, or basically verbalized, that black people are the leftover people. What do they do with us? Collectively, what do you do with us? It was like we all, that character in that moment represented collectively our low self-esteem, that racism, ice cold Coca-Cola's because Chicago was hot at this particular period of time. And that's all she demanded, because that's all she knew that was within her powers in this white racist establishment. She owned her voice, and they wanted something, and that's what she could barter with. So you could go somewhere else, but you wouldn't get the Ma Rainey sound. And that's it. The movie exemplifies the culture of that time. It spoke to cultural appropriation and black rage, because the way they treated the Ma Rainey character, the deepness of her experience was basically experienced by everyone that was in that band, and every black person anyways that lived during that period of time. And it was all very shameful. But in order to know and to be cognizant, I guess, of the gnarly bits of our history, you would learn from them, because you don't want to go back to that type of mentality, that racist, white supremacist mentality, because of how hurtful it is. Because I believe if they had learned from the horror of their ways and sought retribution instead of just telling them, here's $5 and go sit down somewhere, how further we could have gone. If they weren't just trying to cheat her and just trying to rule over her, how much further could they have gone if they had really been together and to protect her and to advance that particular musical genre? Also, I feel that how dare you make her record, and she knew this, it sounds like she knew this too. What was the point of singing and being difficult because of being
I got a friend to call Jackson Sam, who's crazy about all the ladies dancing. Black bottom stops and new baby Francis. The other night at a swell affair, soon as the boys found out that I was there, they said, come on, Ma, let's go to the cabaret. When I got there, they began to say, I want to see the dancing called the Black Bottom. I want to learn that game. Want to see the dance you call your Big Black Bottom. They put you in a trap. All the boys in the neighborhood, they say, your Black Bottom is really good. Come on, show me your Black Bottom.
Particular movie, but I see not only him, I see the producer, which is Denzel Washington, and every single actor and actress winning. They should be nominated and should win major awards, because they embodied every single character that they actually played. And I'm sure that posthumously, Chadwick Boseman is going to get a shout out too, and he's well worth it in his embodiment of the Levi character. I watched the afterword, and basically he had spoken with Brentford Marsalis to get a fingering chart. So, and he basically wanted to know where on his coronet did his fingers need to be for every note. And he also talked to some of the musical director from The Tonight Show, so he could really learn his part, how to basically play the coronet, because how it was important to him. Yes, he was crazy. And yes, he didn't require, and his rage was that he knew that the white owner of the record was going to dupe him. And how racism is. You came through on your end of it. You play the music, you get out the South, you survive not being lynched, and you got a sound that you know is going to blow up. And then you get told by the white man, I'm only going to give you $5 a sound, take it or leave it, and there's nothing that you can do about it. So you turn your psychotic rage over to somebody scuffs your $11 shoes, your gaiters. That scene itself to me was very poignant. And it was also symbolizing the rage of the time. He didn't go crazy until then and on his own people because until he was again duped by the white man, and his own self-hate caused him to basically kill someone in his that was considered his family, his bandmate. It also made him get fired because it was so wild that he had the paternalistic. He was opportunistic. Number one, evidently, Ma Rainey she was ticked off because he was only the Levi character was talented, but he was only there for opportunity because he wanted his sound and possibly take over her band. If they had not been so hurt and damaged, maybe they could have worked together, and they both together could have brought her sound and his sound to an even bigger audience and kept all that scratch. And they could have been more notorious, even than Bessie Smith. But because both were damaged and she was feeling some kind of way, she couldn't see that. So he got terminated. And that's one of the last scenes was him going off because the greedy white man basically reneged on his promise. And he knew he could, and he knew the Levi would not have a leg to stand on. And he used those same songs and gave it to an all-white band and recorded those songs and probably made a complete grip. I thought it was disgusting. But so's were the times. The pain, another poignant thing that Denzel Washington said, that the times have changed, but the pain is the same. All of those things, not owning your own masters, not owning even your images. It was so hard trying to get an uncopyrighted image of Bessie Smith. The few that are out there belong to Getty. That's not her foundation, if there is one. And just being able to listen to her music and who owns the rights to those music. A lot of those people that own and created those egregious contracts are long gone, but we still have her voice, we still have her song, we still have her story. And this is one of those things, if you want to see an unvarnished look of the history of blues, as well as this particular artist, you need to watch. It's one of those great movies that you should basically watch on Netflix. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, watch it at your leisure. You're going to have to rewatch it again because it's brilliant, as well as download the music from the Netflix film. You can listen to it on Amazon, as I've done, as well as on, I'm sure, Spotify, Apple, and Pandora. Billy Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall, what's that, the most famous reindeer of all? Come on! Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, had a very shiny nose. Yes, for the novice. I was looking at my Amazon Music trying to find the Temptations rendition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I rolled up on the DMX rendition. What in the world, y'all? What in the world? I was tripping out so much that the idea of me of finding that was just so hilarious to me. When I was absolutely not looking for some blasted DMX of it all. This is what I was looking for. This is the Temptations, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer on a Motown Christmas. So, but that truly sent me the most angriest Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer I've ever listened to in my life. And you can find it on my playlist, but you need to look it up, and it just listens. It's just so forced, it's so crazy, DMX, that you actually just need to just have listened to it and trip it out. Maybe have a couple of cocktails, we'll make it even funnier. But that's how I'm going to start out this section, my additions to my Christmas playlist. You will find some genuinely incongruous people that are singing these songs like DMX and Rudolph. He evidently had a whole Christmas album. How you rap a whole Christmas album, I don't know. But DMX actually did it. But this section, because I'm leaning into my Twitter handle, I'm making sure that, or just trying to become better at one of my social media platforms that I've had the longest was between Facebook and Twitter is Twitter, TV Food and Wine Girl. And one of the things that I actually like doing now in this time of the COVID panorama has been to cook Christmas dinner. This past weekend, I had one more bone of a rib roast that I actually cooked a few days prior. And I did not realize just the combination of just using these natural ingredients between the carrots and the apples and the what was left of the red potatoes, all of those things and the five spice and this kosher salt, all of those and the mushrooms, portobello mushrooms and the other leftover mushrooms, that all of those things in combination served to tenderize the meat even more. And it just made such a great and savory meal today. And I invite you to take a closer look at the expanded notes or on my Instagram post, Tim Fro is eating or Tim Fro is reading, and you actually see those pictures I displayed within the last hour or so. And because it'll make you almost lick the screen because, y'all, it was good for sure. And it also makes me want to get back into some other activity because I'm trying to lose my COVID 50. But it's hard because food is so good and I don't like people. And so there you go. Sundays are for reading, and in particular, the New York Sunday Times. Arts and leisure sections, the book review, sometimes the Times Magazine, as well as At Home. I just realized that they don't really have a travel section anymore because ain't nobody trying to go anywhere or can go anywhere because of the COVID. So I spent a lot of time just kind of skimming through the front page and the business section. Anytime I see that Pinch Fay mango looking mug from the occupant of the White House, I just have to turn it because they make me so ill. I am happy that there is help on the way in the guise of the COVID vaccine, but I'm in that tier where I probably won't get it until like the third or fourth round, which is not until next summer. But I'm still hopeful that we may get control of it, but you would never know that. And the numbers, you would never know how high the numbers are and the death rate, because I still see people rolling around with no, whole families just rolling around with no mask on. It's like, how dare you not protect yourself and not protect others? bunch of dumbasses. That's why I don't go out, because I hate people. People are stupid. I just think they're really ridiculously stupid. And what I do spend a lot of time on is continuing to read for fun. And I just finished reading Sophie Kinsella, Christmas Shopaholic. Did not fail, did not disappoint. It was hysterical. It all is on the premises of Becky Bloomwood, Becky Brandon, Bloomwood, who seems to be kind of hapless. Youngish, 30-ish, skinny white girl, lives in London, or in Leatherby, which is outside of London, works for a good friend of hers. She is appointed to carry off Christmas for her family and for friends. And it's really complicated because she's never done it before, and two, she's a total flake. But somehow she pulls it off at the same time, shoring up a good someone that really needed her, someone that her husband had recently left her. Supporting her vegan, tree-hugging half-sister, Jess, who adopted an orphan, I guess, from Chile, who's also deaf, helps to put together her mother and the next door neighbor, Janice, even though they tried to do these digs at each other and went all wonky when parents went on adventure and moved to Shoreditch. And I know there's going to be another sequel to this because one of the presents that Jess had given everyone, because it was supposedly a totally non-wasteful gift, they gave each person a word. Becky basically accosted her husband and basically put him on blast and say, how about you give me a word? And he gives her the word beloved. And then she gives him a word because one of the things they had talked about kind of intermittently in the book was that she loves her daughter Minnie and she would want to have a second child. But they had been trying and it had been all for naught. But Becky reveals her word for Luke at the end of the book was pregnant. So I can't wait to see second time around pregnant Becky and how she handles it all. And I'm sure her world is going to be in complete chaos, but she's going to pull it off. And who knows, maybe Sophie Kinsella will write Becky and Luke having like twins or triplets as he's fending off greedy, entitled ex-girlfriends or this Nadine character who basically tried to sabotage Christmas. That's one thing I thought was a little bit off. Why would Nadine go through so much trouble to spoof Luke's email just to make Becky or to hurt Becky? That was kind of trifling, and it was also, it could be considered, I guess, assault because her intent was a malicious intent, and I think it was absolutely horrible. But it all works out, and she ends up pulling off a vegan turkey made of donuts, as well as a real turkey that looked, sounded pretty good once it was delivered. But how can you actually cancel a turkey and say you're going to substitute it with turkey slices? That's some bullshit right there, because I would have went a gangster cray cray. But she did actually have a backup turkey. But who has backup turkeys? I'm just saying. But that book is actually included or on my online bookstore called Chatterbooks. It's Christmas Shopaholic by Sophie Kinsella. If you order it now, you may actually get it the day before Christmas, because if you didn't order anything by like the 16th, you ain't gonna probably, it may be really difficult to get it unless you pay a grip for Express. But that book is actually available. And I did add a couple of additions to the children's and youth section of Chatter Books. The Of Salt and Shore. This is a story about a girl, Lampy, who is the lighthouse keeper's daughter, but must light the lamp to warn ships away from the rocks. But one stormy night, for whatever reason, she didn't do what she was done. So she was sent to some old curmudgeon's house, and it's full of secrets and ghosters and monsters. And this reminded the New York Times reviewer of two books that she also read as a child. The Secret Garden by Frances Hodges, and the wonderful illustrations by Tasha Tudor, and Kipling's, Robert Louis Stevenson, I gotta correct that in my blog, Treasure Island, and how it was brilliantly. That book I'm actually probably gonna get myself, because one is hardback, but I'm told that the illustrations are amazing. And this is a book that you actually should all have in your own libraries, just because, and also just be really cognizant about what you're allowing your kids to read. This dystopian and end of the world apocalyptic read, some of these graphic novels are not enriching their mind. They're basically crushing their spirit in a very difficult time. Make sure that you, as well as the kids, are not reading anything that is going to make you feel worse, or that it's going to fill you with anxiety. It should be these beautiful books filled with artwork and beautiful words that transport you to some fantastical world that is just going to make you feel happy. That's what we should be reading. And basically, and again, this is taking a definite interest in your kids to make sure that they are reading things that will educate them and also uplift them. And I admonish you to do this. Thanks. I always think about who wouldn't want to do this for a living. If all I had to do was sit and read books, make comments on them, and record a podcast and get people to sponsor it, because I know that there are other people that are willing and want to do what I do for free. And I'm going to leave you with this little ditty from Boyz II Men and Brian McKnight. This should be on everybody's Christmas playlist, because I think it truly exemplifies what I think about is Christmas. It's a feel-good song, and I'm hopeful that this exemplifies, it just recaps everything about the spirit of the season, the beauty of the season, how we deal with it in song. And I hope you guys have enjoyed this podcast. I invite you to navigate to alibris.com and use my coupon codes to get anywhere between 10 to 20 off your gift shipment, as well as the total price of your product. Writersblock.com also makes great gifts for the coffee drinker in you that makes coffee an experience. And of course, for those buttheads that need a bag of gummy penises, navigate to shipabagofdicks.com and use my promo code 10forgotjokes or marydicks to get up to 20-25% off of your order, as well as shipping. And if I don't see you, or if you don't listen to my podcast before the end of this week, I hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year's, and thank you for listening.